quarter improvement plan that the General Assembly says we need to investigate I-95. So the same, almost the same type of language that was put in the bill for I-81 was used for the I-95 plan. I'll get into that a little bit more as we go. But I wanted you to know by starting next week, we'll be having 3 meetings on the first set of 12 meetings, of actually 12 meetings in the, actually 9 meetings in the quarter over the next 4 months. And so you can see here in Lorton on the 18th, it's going to be in Fredericksburg on the 23rd, and in Petersburg on the 25th. So those are the 3 meetings that are going to happen on the first round of meetings. They're going to be getting good public input. So what is the purpose of this presentation? To give you an overview of the plan, what is in the actual House and Senate resolutions, the significance of the corridor, some of the summary of the data that we've been looking at for the last 4 months, 3 months, and then what to expect next. So the General Assembly passed these 2 House joint resolutions and Senate joint resolutions to request a study of I-95. Actually, that study was going to be between Fredericksburg, the Thornburg area at 118, all the way to 495. The Secretary, which I'll show you in just a minute, went ahead and extended that corridor all the way from North Carolina to the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. The study was initiated to look at pre-key problem areas along the corridor and to identify any potential solutions and then recommend anything that would be needed for further study. The resolutions say that those meetings need to be completed by November 30th and that the findings will be to the General Assembly in 2020. So this is the corridor on the right there. You will see that the Secretary did indeed extend it for all 179 miles of the corridor in Virginia. It is a very diverse and complex corridor. It also includes the corridors along Route 1 and 301. As you move south of Richmond, Route 301 parallels Route I-95, as does Route 1 up north of Fredericksburg. It's a critical corridor for freight and for movement of people and goods. It is 190 miles, like I said, in Virginia, but it's 1,900 miles from all the entire length of the East Coast. Goes through 15 states, and not including D.C., so it's a major corridor. It's multimodal in nature, as you can see by the different modes that are shown there on the screen, and it's second only to I-81 for the movement of trucks and freight. 9 million trucks per year, 195 billion goods moved per year. And not only that, we unfortunately have over 5,000 crashes a year that occur in the corridor. And many of those crashes end up with incidents that block the lanes of the traffic from one lane of the road for more than 2 hours. And when that happens, then there's this ripple effect that occurs that creates congestion in the corridor. So as we started to look at the different data sets there's a lot of data along this corridor, we started looking at delay. An interesting part about this is we start looking at what we call recurring delay, which is the delay you experience when you're in congestion on roads like 95 going northbound in the morning, or 95 southbound in the evening, or 66 eastbound in the morning. And then there's non-recurring delay that are caused by things such as weather, rain events like we're having this evening, work zones, special events, and holidays, and then even sometimes summertime travel. But as you can see, the recurring delay from Fredericksburg North is about between 70 and 80% of the delay that occurs in the corridor. And there's different solutions that we would come up with for recurring delay versus non-recurring delay. And it flip-flops as you move your way down to Richmond and Fredericksburg. The non-recurring delay becomes predominant, and the recurring delay becomes less of an issue. But you can see in the middle part of that graphic, Richmond, downtown Richmond, between 64 going to Charlottesville and 64 going to Virginia Beach is a problem. And that's where the recurring delay occurs in the Richmond area. We also wanted to look at, it's an important thing for this quarter for us to look at the number of people that are moved in the quarter, not just the number of cars. And so what we've done is we've taken 8 different points along the quarter from number 1, which is actually north. It's between 495 and the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. 2 is just south of 495 or near Franconia. Three is right down near Occoquan, actually 123, where Route 123 comes in. And then four and five are in the Fredericksburg area, just north of Fredericksburg and just south of Fredericksburg. Richmond, just north of 295 and just south of just north of Petersburg. And then lastly, down near Emporia. And so we wanted to see what is the movement of people through those different length areas. And as you can see here, it's interesting to note that the number of people that are non-SOV, that's single occupant vehicle, non-SOV, is higher in the areas north of Occoquan than the SOV vehicles, not SOVs. And that's because of all the different modes of transit, whether it's express, bus, whether it's carpooling and slugging. As a matter of fact, carpooling and slugging accounts for more movement of people than does single occupancy vehicles. And so that is an interesting way to look at this. And when we start looking at improvements, we're going to start looking at what are the transit improvements that can be made, as well as what are the capital improvements that can be made in order for the corridor to operate more efficiently and moving people through the corridor. And as you move south of Fredericksburg, you can see the number of SOVs starts to exceed the number of non-SOVs. I show this slide just so that you can see that we were looking at a lot of different data. This one is actually speeds, and the dashed line is the speed limit. And you can see the speed limit goes from 70 miles an hour to 55 miles an hour as you go through the corridor. But those shaded areas are areas where the speeds drop tremendously during the peak period. This is actually a typical weekday morning going northbound. So when we're traveling northbound, up through Stafford, and then now, of course, when you get just before 123 in Occoquan, you can see those speeds. The speed limit in that area is around 60 miles an hour. The speeds where one in four people are going about this speed limit is around 25 miles an hour. This is an annual day. This is averaged over an entire year worth of information. It's not a day's worth of data. It's an annual worth of data. And you can see the fluctuation speeds are tremendous. I'm going to show you a weekend. This is not a weekday issue. It's a weekend issue as well. But let me go back and forth here. So you see Stafford area and Occoquan. Occoquan actually gets a little bit better during the weekend, but look at Fredericksburg area. There's a tremendous amount of delay, and if any of you travel northbound on the weekend, you know that you slow down quite a bit through the Fredericksburg area, down as low as 40 miles an hour. And then also there's an issue in Ashland, north of Richmond there, on the weekends. And that has a lot to do with where 295 ties in. And so the corridor is very, very diverse from its issues. This information right here is what we're doing is we're going to be showing all of the performance measures along the corridor, whether it's delays or crashes or incidents. And one of the things that the Deputy Secretary asked us to do was to look at 2025. There's some substantial projects being done. These projects right here represent over $1 billion worth of investment that are happening in the corridor over the next, before 2025. And so what we've done on the boards that we're going to be presenting next week is we're showing these improvements as they're actually shown on the plans, the aerials, as designs. And we're showing how those improvements are actually impacting the performance measures, and it is a substantial impact on the performance measures that are currently out there. We're looking at data from 2015 to 2018, and we were able to see that these improvements are actually going to make a substantial difference on those performance measures. And they're improvements all the way from the 123 auxiliary lane near Occoquan down to the acceleration lane improvement on the overlap in Richmond near Belvedere, where there's a lot of crash issues. So there's just a whole host of improvements. And I don't want to forget that there's a very Fredericksburg line extension where there's going to be added capacity improvements there as well. So we were looking at the capital improvements. We're also looking at the operational improvements. And these operations.
Can you go back?
Yes, I can.
I'm going to look at my gear and chair.
And
how we have it. You said very Fredericksburg line extension?
I Did I say that?
Yeah.
Okay, I did not mean that. I'm sorry. There's going to be improvements at the VRE stations. Let's put that.
Yeah. I know all about that.
Otherwise called VCRVA.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. I apologize. I didn't realize I said
that. Wow. Who's paying for this?
No. I have a magical pot of money. No. We also have we're going to be looking at the new park and ride lots, and there's a lot of new park and ride lots planned for the area, for the corridor, and ones that are being expanded. We're looking at the Atlantic Gateway improvements that are being looked at, and of course the biggest part of that is the Long Bridge, and that is something that is beyond our 2025 horizon. We're also looking at changeable message signs, cameras that are going to give us more information, towing programs, and a lot of those kind of improvements are in place north of Fredericksburg and south of Fredericksburg. There's probably going to need to be some gaps filled in some of those areas, and we have identified those areas as well. And I don't want to forget to mention the Safety Service Patrol, which is a big improvement to help clear crashes in a more efficient way.
What's the towing program? I'm curious.
The towing program what it allows for is when tractor trailers have crashes, not every towing company can move a heavy tractor trailer. And so by having a program in place where those contractors are in place that have a first call basis, they can then get to that, they can bring that heavy equipment, get the vehicle off the road quicker, and clear the incident. And those programs are in place along the corridor, but there are some locations where there could be more added as we start to look at this improvement. So these are the performance measures that are going to be looked at initially with this corridor. It's crash frequency and severity, the severity rate, the total delay, and that delay was what some of the stuff I was showing you with the recurring versus non-recurring, and then incident delay, which is the delay that blocks traffic for more than 1 hour, and that was one of those things I was talking about, how many locations of that's happening. And as you move down the corridor, the delay becomes different. It becomes incident delay as you move further south as opposed to the total delay. We are going to be going to the public, giving this information on 8-foot long boards. They're going to be 3 miles on 8-foot long boards, so people will be able to put their feedback onto the boards, as whether it's safety or congestion or transit. And then they will be also having this opportunity to participate in a survey, an online survey. That link that's up there, right there on the screen, virginiacorridormetroquest.com, is live today. Anyone can go on there and give their feedback. And as you see on this screen, it says issues and opportunities. This is one of four screens. It allows you to identify any locations along the corridor where you feel there's a congestion, safety, multimodal, alternative route, some technology solution, or another alternative solution that you can come up with. And that this is going to be also, we're going to have iPads at the public meetings that people can then put their feedback on if they want to at that time. We're going to be moving forward with updates next week, actually, to the CTB for similar to this presentation. We're going to be doing back out with the public to give feedback in September for improvements. At that time, we'll have some recommended improvements that will be a combination of feedback from the public from these first round of meetings, as well as our additional team's investigation of the solutions. And then we'll be back again after that in November to... We're going to do a smart scale-like evaluation of the improvements, and then we're going to come back and have a ranked set of improvements that will then be vetted with the public and with the jurisdictions, anyone that is a stakeholder in the organization here. So this website is live. It has all the public announcements of the meetings on there right now, and as of next week, the boards will be on there as well, and then people can start to digest. There's going to be, for the Northern Virginia meeting, there'll be 6 8-foot boards that will show the corridor. People will be able to put dots on it, and there'll be 16 other boards that people will have opportunities to digest information about the delay and the Safety Service Patrol and the transit and the bus operations and the slugging. All that information will be on boards for people to digest. That's all I have for you.
Just a couple questions, because you started the presentation out talking about how this project, 95, goes to 15 different states. So who's primarily funding this improvement plan?
Right now, the bill that was passed by the General Assembly last year for I-81 allocated in the neighborhood of, when it's fully funded, it'll be in the neighborhood of $40 million per year for the I-95 corridor. There's also money allocated to I-64 in the neighborhood of around $30 million per year. There's a ramp-up period. The first 2 years doesn't get to that $40 million, but that $40 million is what is going to be available for improvements along the I-95 corridor.
So this is just strictly Virginia funding?
Yes.
This 15-state Wallace card. We don't get any federal money on this?
It's Virginia funding Virginia.
Virginia funding just the Virginia portion.
Oh, I mentioned the 15 states just to say that the corridor is very special.
I know, it just piqued my interest when you said that. Okay.
Let me make sure we're clear on something. What we call the I-81 bill provides statewide funding that's allocated on a corridor basis. However, Ms. Hines, correct me on this. The money that's coming on this corridor basis that is raised in Northern Virginia is actually not being applied to the I-95 corridor, but is rather revenue that's flowing to this bond. Correct.
There is money from the IA1 bill that is coming to this body. Mario, I'll confess to you, I'm of the opinion that it has to be spent on the interstate, but I don't know that for sure. So I don't think, because it's being raised on the interstate, the money that we get.
So there's 66 coming into 95.
No, Marty, I'm sorry, Chairman, no, you're correct. Okay. The calculation for how much would come.
Thanks, Tracy.
Sorry, Tracy Bader from Broadway Consulting. The calculation for how much would come to the authority was based on the percentage of heavy truck travel on the interstates in planning District 8. But the money is given to the authority to use for our normal authority activities.
It is not
restricted to interstates. The reason that's important is because there are improvements. It is at least plausible, if not likely, there are improvements that will be identified by this study that can be funded with the money that he just referenced. But it is much more likely that's going to happen south of Chappell-Wamsa Creek than it is in Northern Virginia, because Fredericksburg, Richmond, Hampton Roads districts, the money is allocated explicitly to the highway corridor. Northern Virginia is the one district where the money is transportation fund rather than corridor specific.
There is one small category of funding that was not identified for a specific interstate corridor like 64 or 95 or 81. Off the top of my head, I can't remember how much it was. Less than, oh, there you go.
Yeah,
I didn't bring my chart.
Yeah, Maria provided this. It's around $20 million that goes to that's been assigned to the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority. Yeah.
And then there's like a catch-all.
There's a catch-all.
Interstate improvements?
Yeah.
There's an interstate improvements one that's $45 million.
That will be at the CPB's discretion.
Yes.
So if I may then, the study that you're conducting will identify potential improvements that you then would, not as DRPT, but rather work with the agencies that are related to submit for consideration for MBTA funding? I'm sure trying to understand.
This is a study to say, here's what would be great if we could do it.
Okay.
The next phase after this study is done will fall to CTB, to DRPT, to NBTA, others, although the others never seem to appear, to identify how we would pay for the said improvements.
Yes, that's right.
And many of the said improvements might not happen.
But the improvements would need project champions, sponsors.
Certainly.
Sure.
Just like every project.
Yeah. So on 81, what's happened is that there's a body that's been stood up that has CPB members on it and people from the various planning districts. There's a menu of projects. There were $4 billion worth of projects identified on the 81 corridor, of which they prioritized $2 billion. And then there's going to be this group that's going to basically do a little like we do, where we prioritize and say this before that. So I think it's highly likely they're going to identify way more projects than there's this kind of fund, than funding exists. I believe this is a bondable.
I don't know about that.
Stream.
Well, it's all state money, so it's technically all bondable by the state. Yeah.
By the state. So potentially they can leverage it into more, but Yeah, so there's going to be this mix and match of what can we do with the money we have, what is the biggest bang for the buck. And then part of that is what they'll bring back in the third meeting, having sort of looked at all the projects and trying to get a bang for the buck duties first.
Yeah, we'll be prioritizing them.
They'll be prioritizing, but no one should assume that when this study is done that the projects are funded. Although there'll be a prioritization, so.
And there'll be some way to use the money that's been assigned,
yeah,
the annual money, to do some things. And maybe some projects will come in smart scale. I mean, that is in fact, there were projects in smart scale that got funded this year that were identified as priorities because people knew where their congestion was.
So that's good. That brings me to the other part. Since even though this is a highway project for 95, they also added Route 1 and 301, which we often overlook as far as all that. So we saw yesterday when that Amazon truck had 95 shut down, everybody jumped on Route 1 and jumped off, and the portion of 95 was actually shut down. And so we seen that impact a lot of our localities.
Yeah, of course. For 81, we identified around $43 million worth of improvements off of 81 that were because of incident management type of improvements. And so that would be the similar type of a plan that we'd be developing for here, mainly for incident management.
Two questions. First, how long are you going to conduct the study?
It's got to be done by December.
Oh, it's by the end
of this year. So it's going to be less than 12 months, big time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It started in April.
Okay, and are you going to look at the times of day of congestion?
Yes.
Obviously, you can't look for the seasonal flow because, I mean, we all know with the holidays, especially July 4th, just passing, that was a big rush hour, and I'm sure you can see the peaks and also dips of traffic depending on holidays, but it's difficult since it's less than a year.
Yeah, we are looking at past year's worth of information so we can see summer influences and we can also see
school
influences. We can also see
and are you gonna get
day and week influences.
Are you going to get granular in terms of the types of vehicles like tractor trailers besides the SOVs that are traveling down 95?
Well, we are, I mean, obviously their trucks are a major freight corridor, so yes, we will be looking at the truck flows, and most of the data that we pulled, we have both in passenger cars and in trucks, so that we can start to see what trends are happening. We're doing a whole lot of origin destination investigations, which means like people are coming from Richmond. Are people coming from Fredericksburg? Where are they going in Northern Virginia? Are they going through to Baltimore? Are they going to 495? Are they going to the west? Are they going 495 to the east? And if they're coming from Fredericksburg, do they have an option to use 301, 207 to 301, as opposed to using 95? So that is a bigger thing when you start looking at the difference between passenger cars doing that versus tractor trailers.
One final question. If you had longer time to conduct this study, I mean, could you look at that seasonal flow and other things as well? What would they be?
Well, I mean, I think we're doing the best we can to investigate all this seasonal information. I wouldn't say that we're gonna not have any stone unturned. It's just a matter of how much detail can we get into the development of concepts. That's where our time constraint is going to be. Not necessarily analyzing the data and summarizing that in a way that helps us to make some decisions.
I'm just curious what a follow-up question there. Are you guys able to use data from Transurban and, like EasyPass?
We just got that information from them this past week, yes.
So, okay.
Actually, Monday.
Okay.
That's how we were trying to estimate the number of vehicles who are car pulling, van pulling, and also in SOVs. We got information from them to corroborate the information that we're pulling from other studies.
So,
any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Next up, we have a state of the regional multimodal mobility program.
She's been.
Oh.
So, Mr. Chairman, if you've heard me speak to this before, this regional multimodal mobility program is essentially, or I should say it was the Authority Smart Scale application, and we talked about how in talking to the Secretary's office, they informed us that they thought that this would be a good candidate for the Innovation Transportation Technology Fund instead of Smart Scale, which was great, but it now requires us to move more quickly than we thought we would because Smart Scale was on fiscal year 25 regarding their funding allocation. We are doing this project in collaboration with the Commonwealth, but even though it's MBTA in the Commonwealth, I do want to note that we are having meetings or scheduling meetings. We did have a stakeholder meeting with all of the transit agencies because that's a big component of this. I should also state that at the June CTB meeting, they did approve the allocation of funding, the $15 million for this project. So as of July 1, we're fully funded and ready to go. And I'll turn it over to Keith.
Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members of the authority. Monica has just stolen all my thunder, so I think I'll just leave this slide with you. The acronym RN3P is a challenge, and just to clarify, it's neither of these two folks, but they do seem to have similar names. But anyway, if you can
remember, I love how the Star Wars references keep coming.
I thought I'd throw you something there to respond. So, what is it? It's a collaborative initiative, as Monica said. Between us, BDOT, and DRPT. I'll kind of really highlight the sub-bullet below the first bullet, which is the authority's vision statement, the transaction that you approved in December of 2015. And as vision statements go, this one is really visionary because you called out right away, as we've highlighted in bold here, the multimodal transportation system, employ the best technology, and an interconnected network. And that really is what RN3P is trying to do, to use information and communications technologies to provide a different approach to addressing the region's problems in terms of mobility and congestion that complements the more traditional infrastructure approaches, certainly won't replace them. And we're looking to optimize system performance, improve travel time reliability, and support on-demand multimodal trip options through this system. There is a history to this, which is worth stating because it's very, very relevant to how this project will actually be implemented. It grew out of an initiative that was called the East-West Integrated Corridor Management Project, which was a VDOT-led initiative a couple of years ago. And ICM is a different way of looking at dealing with transportation problems. It's multimodal, it's multi-agency, it's dynamic, and it's looking to manage conditions in a more holistic way than just fixing a single facility. It also is looking to manage and modify travel behavior. So it's looking at both capacity and demand. And anything we can do to make even small changes in the way travelers choose their routes, their modes, when they travel, if they travel. These even small things can lead to big differences in travel conditions on a network as saturated as Northern Virginia's. The East-West study was kind of centered on I-66, I would say, but the scope of that project was from Route 7 in the north to the VRE Manassas line in the south, from Route 15 in the west all the way to the Potomac River in the east. So it is a very large wedge of real estate in Northern Virginia, and the bit that wasn't covered by that study had been covered by an earlier ICM study in the I-95 and 395 corridor. So those two pieces together really gives us a solid platform to look at the region as a whole. We did apply for funding jointly with VDOT and DRPT a couple of summers ago for some federal funding. And as Monica said, we took the initiative last year to pursue Smart Scale funding, and we're very grateful to the CTB for agreeing what a wonderful project this was and identify a funding source that not only meant that we could advance the project, but we could actually start the project about 4 years earlier than we thought we'd be starting it, which is great, and it's been challenging at the same time. So this ITTF fund, the Innovation and Technology Transportation Fund, is different funding that's used for Smart Scale. It's, as the name suggests, focused on innovation and technology. And there are five things here that ITTF funds focus on and try to achieve with respect to technology. And as you can see, many of these things are things which the authority tries to do as well. So reduce congestion, improve mobility, provide up-to-date travel data are all very, very important components here. And even improving safety and improving emergency response, which are not directly the responsibility of authority, will benefit from this project. And the evaluation of projects that we submitted for ITTF funding, five things listed here at the bottom, this project checks all of these boxes. It's innovative, it's potentially transferable to elsewhere in the Commonwealth, if not indeed the whole Commonwealth. It applies across multiple modes. There's a benefit that will come from this, which could be enormous if it works. And finally, the acceptability of risk. There's always a risk with technology projects. This technology project is kind of moving the envelope a long way out from what most regions around the country do, let alone within the Commonwealth. And so this funding source accepts that there is a risk with doing these sorts of things. But things that are worth risking, you know, if the return to that risk in this case is very, very high. And if we're not successful, we will still learn things that will be very important for future approaches. So, we're very grateful for the Commonwealth for making this happen. In terms of how it's going to be managed, I think the management structure here reflects the significance that the Commonwealth holds in this project. And Kathy McGee, who is the Commonwealth's Director of Transportation, Innovation and Research, is going to be leading this project. So it's essentially co-sponsored between Kathy and Monica, who will also be on the leadership side of this project. Activated in July 2019, that's not a typo. It was activated on 1st of July this month. So we've really hit the ground running already. As Monica suggested, we've actually done some preparatory work in the hope and anticipation that this will actually be approved in June by the CTB. The day-to-day management is going to be between ourselves, VDOT and DRPT staff, but there's going to be a huge collection of regional stakeholders who will be involved in making this project work, and we hope to have a kickoff meeting with those in fall, September if we can make it happen, if not early October of this year. I've listed just generically some of the types of stakeholders who will be involved. There are just simply too many to actually list here. But it's really important to note that the previous work that was done under the ICM, the East-West ICM project, has created the institutional framework for the success of this project. Technology projects are not really as much about the technology. The technology, by and large, is much more robust than the institutional integration that's required to make the technology achieve its greatest potential. And the ICM project achieved that. So the groundwork that was done in 2016 and 2017 has really given us the platform to dive straight into this very fast. The completion in fall of 2022 is realistic, but I would say that there is a high hope and expectation that many of the kind of the early win deliverables associated with this project will actually emerge by fall of 2021, 2 years from now. So what will it deliver in 2021 and 2022? I won't go into these in great detail, but there are four distinct deliverable areas that we're working on, but these are all kind of integrated with one another. It isn't just four different things. It's four different things that are going to work together. So enhanced commuter parking data, looking to get real-time parking utilization information from as many parking lots as we can afford to equip with the project funds. So this will probably focus on one or two corridors rather than the entire region. there are plenty of parking lots out there with a higher amount of utilization where it's hard to know dynamically in real time how many spaces are left. And that's really important when you want to divert someone away from a road or from driving alone, and you can't be sure that you're sending them somewhere where there's a space for them to park. So this will really help us with that. The mobility as a service dashboard is really focused on transportation service providers, and what this is going to do is attempt to identify gaps in transportation services today on a dynamic basis and provide that information so that transportation service providers in both the public and private sectors can offer services that will meet those service gaps, and in so doing provide perhaps first and last mile service options that will prevent people from otherwise driving from their origin to their destination and possibly driving alone. So every one of those trips we can capture in some other way where there's shared mobility involved is going to be helping the entire region reduce congestion. The artificial intelligence-based decision support system, what's really novel here is the prediction component. We're actually going to be looking to use artificial intelligence to anticipate issues that will arrive in the next 2 to 4 hours and begin to proactively respond to something that's not happened yet. Sounds very Star Wars-ish, but in reality, even compared to where we thought we were in the industry a year ago when we submitted the application, there are now actually vendors out there offering these sorts of services. So we think this may end up being actually an easier lift than we thought when we submitted the application, which was thinking we would get smart scale money in 2024. So the fact that we got money earlier is great, but it made us think, well, the technologies we were assuming in 2024, do they actually exist in 2019? And it turns out in many cases they actually do. The final part of this is the incentivization piece of this, which is looking to provide tools that will provide customers, travelers, with a choice of multimodal options, again, instead of driving alone. But in this case, to actually incentivize that trip behavior change, which may be, you know, change of route, change of mode, a change of time, going to Starbucks, working there for 2 hours before you get back onto 66 or 29 or whatever, and so doing, I was thinking just a couple of days ago how this system, if it had been in place now, could have been used on Monday with the weather we had then to incentivize some people to maybe not travel or to use Metro instead of driving. I know Metro had some waterfalls in some of its stations, but it was actually still moving, so that might have worked if people had known. So that's what we're trying to do with this RNC project. And just to wrap up, the authority is not kind of dipping its toe into technology for the first time ever with this project. This is actually just the next step in a continuation of technology initiatives that the authority is engaged in. Directly, the authority has invested in about a half a dozen projects to the tune of about $17 million for ITS projects, predominantly in Arlington and the city of Alexandria. Many of you know we host an annual roundtable. Next year will be the fifth iteration of that roundtable. It started off looking at disruptive transportation technologies. And movement in this marketplace is so fast that we just come back every year and do another roundtable on disruptive technologies, and we never go over the same ground as the previous year, such as the pace of change. The Transportation Technology Committee, which was created late last year, it's an advisory body to the executive director, that actually met for the third time yesterday, and that is a body which is a mix of public and private sector experts in the field of technology who are advising us on a number of things, including how we address technology in the next iteration of transaction, the long-range transportation plan. Driven by Innovation is our our regular e-blast to subscribers on all things technology that appear to have some real relevance to this region. We actually get it out about once a month. We aspire to get it out every 2 weeks, but resources permitting, we will be doing that more frequently in the future. And then again, the transaction scenario analysis. I mentioned transaction earlier in the context of the technology committee, but the scenario analysis referred to here is really looking at the uncertainty in the future, given that we plan out to 2040 or 2045. The uncertainty in the path that technology will take over that time period is really important to us in our planning efforts. We don't want to advise you to invest in something which is going to be the wrong thing. So we're looking at different scenarios for the future and how that might change the way we make recommendations on future investment decisions. So it's a really important thing for us as well. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Questions, Mr. Jen? The last slide, we have the four deliverables. As I look at it, the second and third bullets are ones that deliverables go to the providers. The first and the fourth goes to consumers. My question is, will that give rise to something like the V.5.1.1 app that a consumer can actually go into and get that data to make your kind of decision? If you're rising in the morning in the year 2023, this is already online. Could a consumer actually draw down that data and make a decision which way she's going to commute? Would that be, is there a deliverable that is consumer-friendly?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I can't tell you right now with any certainty what the deliverables will be because it's only July 11th and we started 2 days ago. We'll have more clarification on that as we move through the next couple of months. But yes, you're absolutely right. What's underlying the whole of this project is data. Okay, so, and real-time data that can be processed and use it in a way to achieve certain goals. This is a needs-driven project. We're not doing technology because it's bright and shiny and fun and different. We're doing this because we have a problem and we think technology, along with infrastructure, offers us ways to address the problems that we have. So, yeah, any information we can get that's actionable in the hands of or on the devices of travelers in Northern Virginia, we believe will help to make a difference. And again, remember I said, we're not looking for big differences. If we can move 3 or 5% of people, that will have a huge impact. So some of the information will go off to the providers to be repackaged and made consumable. Some of it we might provide directly to consumers ourselves. I think the actual business model that we use for dealing with that as we go forward is going to emerge as we go forward. We don't want to reinvent new wheels though. So if something already exists, we are not going to duplicate it. We'll try and incorporate it into what we're doing.
Thank you.
On this side as well, with regard to the first bucket of potential deliverables, as you study the parking lots, do you see within that scope an opportunity to look for ways to technologically better enable or facilitate flooding? Do you see that as pretty outside of the scope? This is really about directing folks to parking lots, not enabling or facilitating them picking up other riders while they're there.
That's a good question. I mean, it is primarily focused on helping people to be aware of parking lots where there's space that matches with their particular journey. I think, to be honest, within the scope of this project, that would be going too far. It's not that it can't be done, but even with 15 million, it probably cannot be done.
It may be of interest for a future, we'll see what flooding culture looks like in the future, but when I think about how technological predictability has been able to reduce a lot of the sociological barriers to getting in a car with strangers, the way Uber, Lyft, other TNCs have done, I wonder if there isn't a parallel gain to be developed in the public interest around flooding by the use of technology.
I believe that has to be true. One of the things that's kind of we're weighing up in our minds as we decide which corridors to equip first is, there is an established culture of flooding in 95 corridor. There is not the same culture in the 66 corridor, But by 2022, that might actually be very different to how it is today. So, you know, thinking about whether investing in the 66 corridor for that part of the deliverable versus the 95 corridor, it's one of the things we're weighing up. And we heard earlier about the 95 study that's going on. And so it's how does technology factor into that study is something that we're keen to see as well. You know, the timescales of that study and this project are actually very complementary. So I honestly don't know the answer to a question. We haven't had that conversation yet.
Send that question to Kim
Horn,
actually, about
95.
For 95?
Yeah.
How can technology better facilitate?
Yeah.
I was imagining, you know, technology helping you as you're leaving mm-hmm. in the morning or coming back at night and telling it what your destination is, and for it to be able to look at all your modes of transportation and you know, give you advice as to take the train because there's capacity and no backups, at least at this point, and or, you know, smooth sailing, you know, if you're driving and or if you're carpooling, blah, blah, blah. I guess ultimately it would be great to have technology that would do that for you. Right now we listen to the radio. We listen to the radio and listen to, you know, listen ourselves to what is happening if we're smart.
Right.
And then make a decision as far as our commute
right.
goes. Wouldn't it be great to have technology that actually helped you with that?
Right.
No, you're absolutely right, Kevin Boulevard. I think one of the things, again, we get to decide on how we're going to do this, but this project gives the opportunity. You know, if people want to participate on a subscription basis, then you know, and they'd obviously have to be in the right corridor if we're only equipping certain corridors or certain you know, high density locations where a lot of people drive today. But if yeah, people in those locations as part of the piloting process subscribe to the system, then I can certainly anticipate that you know, before they leave home in the morning, they've already received some information through some medium as to what to anticipate on their trip, because you know, we don't want them to set off if it's going to take them twice as long to get to where they're going as it normally would, and when if they do go, they're just going to add to a problem that already exists.
Everybody does the same thing.
Exactly, and the other side of that is, you know, if you're already at work, well, if you've driven to work, you're already committed to driving home. You don't really have quite the range of options at that point, unless you've got free overnight parking. But it, you know, again, we could anticipate maybe at lunchtime that certain conditions are beginning to form where, you know, certain things look like they're going to be coming into play. You know, it's a bit like weather forecasts in a way. It's like, you know, we kind of can predict with some degree of certainty into the future, but the closer you are to the future, then the certainty levels begin to go up. So, again, we don't know how that's going to play out. But I don't see why that sort of thing couldn't be considered.
From our perspective so far, is we have really tried hard to put as much of the data, signal timing, protecting it, but putting it out there so people can use that. Because there's far more people who can write these apps and do great things that they can continue to update than I think we will ever have staff to do. And so I think the real hope is that you put the data out there and you put all the data. You put all the data from the towns, the cities, all the signal timings, so that somebody takes that. So we're working with car manufacturers who are taking that data, putting it in the car so that the folks know the timing. But also I believe, I wanna say Waze is looking at, so that people don't have to show up to slug mm-hmm. at the metro, that they're in their neighborhood and three people in that neighborhood are going in the same direction. And there's an app that says, hey, I'm going today, maybe I don't go every day, maybe I just go one day a week, that there are already those programs out there. So how do we encourage that? Because this is going to be dynamic, and we will never keep up with it as well as a lot of these technology folks out there are going to keep up with it. So the hope is that you don't have people standing. Eventually don't stand and don't have to slug it. They walk out their door and they get in the car right outside their door, which would be less cars on the road, less people driving to the metro or driving to the bus station.
I'm totally right. I mean, and to a large extent, what's missing today is the data, right? And this project will go a long way towards providing new data and testing the value of that data through, you know, apps developed by the app community as opposed to us or VDOT. Yeah, so it's a different way of approaching things. So, you know, there's that risk element in there, but it, you know, the Commonwealth clearly recognised this is a risk worth taking, and we agree with the Commonwealth. But it's their money, not ours.
It's your money.
The question, will this data be proprietary or will be available to commercial entities also? Like, as you said, as Corbin mentioned, Waze. You have Waze and Google. If you get them the data, they might be able to proliferate it quicker and more expeditiously than the government. Is this somehow, is there any competition? Are we in some ways replicating what they're already doing? I guess that's question number two. When is the data going to be available, freely available to commercial entities that can also use it? And then two, are we replicating any way what they're already doing?
Well, certainly the intent is to make the data available. Obviously, we've got to strip off anything that is personally identifiable information. I think for the most part, we won't be collecting any personally identifiable information. So, you know, it's going to be made available. There's no intent here to kind of keep it to ourselves, as it were. The value of this is sharing the data. But we've got to, you know, take some, you know, due diligence steps to make sure that we don't, you know, cause any privacy issues or even protect against cyber security issues. In terms of the duplication, as I said before, it's not our intent to reinvent any wheel. So if something is there that already exists, and again, this is a very dynamically moving area on the private sector as well. What I would say is that the Waze and Uber and Lyft will certainly be invited to be part of the stakeholder group. You know, we've talked with those organisations. Indeed, there's an Uber representative on our transportation technology committee. So, you know, they're very interested in participating with us. You know, this isn't going to catch them by surprise because they already have been participants in the process and are interested to work more. So I think, you know, they've got a particular business model that they use, and we've got a business model that we want, which is to basically, you know, have people travel more in shared vehicles than not in shared vehicles, to travel less distance rather than more distance. And so that's what we're trying to get out of this. And we think there are going to be ways where we can work together to get a project that satisfies our goals at the same time, not in any way undermining their business model.
If I could, Delegate Hugo, as Keith was saying, yesterday the Transportation Technology Committee met, and we do have representatives from those sectors on the committee, and they were given the same presentation, and they're just as interested in regarding what it will lead to as well, and are willing to offer up the information they have so that we can make sure that we do get some products that do succeed out of this. So they didn't look at it as a competition.
Actually, we do believe that they're going to add data to this as well as use data from it.
I just think you get this information to the private entities, a lot better. You've got, what, the 511 app, which is very good and well done, but I don't know how well known it is.
Yeah.
And what the private industry can do is just better advertise and communicate that with folks. This opportunity is out there to use if they're given that data. They're going to monetize it, I mean, I understand that. But they monetize and it benefits all of us.
I agree.
Anything else? Thank you. All right. Consent agenda. We have three items. These are all standard project agreements allowed now. These agreements we have.
I will approve the consent agenda.
Second. Second. Mr. Minshew. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Action items. First, will you give us an explanation on this? We haven't done this.
We have projects that have withdrawn, but never one that I guess is technically
Yes.
The projects that were projects withdrawn before we had conducted the appropriation of the funds. We had approved them in the program, but they never reached the appropriation stage.
This is our first de-appropriation. On appropriation? The appropriation.
The appropriation.
Doesn't change our 6-year plan.
No, we're not going to let your. Here's going to be the explanation, too.
Thank you, Chairman Lane, authority members. As way of background on this project, it was approved as part of the 2014 program for $1.3 million, which was designed at the time to complete a $10 million funding cost for construction on the concept of placing a tunnel underneath the railroad tracks to link the DRE station with WMATA. The construction of the pedestrian tunnel ended up not being feasible. However, DRE did come up with an alternative to use an existing structurally sound tunnel that kind of takes this project off the table. And DRE passed a motion in January of this year to authorize on their side the termination of the project. So they're actually asking for this as well. Their motion is attached, and if you look at the third and fourth whereas on there, it actually gives some of the details of your approach to this, which is basically, again, using the existing tunnel. It goes, you know, staff report goes into some detail about placing elevators and stuff like that to make ADA compliance. So with this, if the authority acts to reappropriate this evening, the $1.3 million just basically goes back into the regional revenue pot for the 2-year update that will be coming forward in the summer of 2020. And with that, if there's any questions, obviously.
This is $10 million. This is $10 million FY 15 money.
$1.3 million.
Oh, $1.3 million FY 15 money that comes back to the next 6-year plan.
Yes. Okay.
Any questions? Motion to approve. Second from Ms. Bulma. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Next, we've got the 2020 Regional Revenue Fund Appropriation Cancellation in the town of Dumfries, Route 1 / Grevy Boulevard project. Another thing we've done.
Well, we actually have done this. We've moved an appropriation to the town of Vienna. This was developed in conjunction with the town, and the key thing to remember with this, unlike the VRE action item that just took place, this does not cancel the project. It's simply canceled the 2020 appropriation with an idea that it will probably come back into 2021 appropriation request. The authority has put a little over $51 million on this project through two funding allotments. The first one was $6.9 million for preliminary engineering. The current one that we're talking about is $44.8 million, which is targeted to right-of-way. Moving the appropriation out of the fiscal 2020 keeps the project from having a conflict with Policy 29. The appropriation requires an SPA to be done within a certain amount of time and then triggers a series of spending things. So this gives the project some breathing room, mostly targeted with identifying funding opportunities for the $80 million that the project needs for construction costs. The town applied for but was not awarded smart scale funding for that in the most recent round, and the town has indicated they are going to be looking again for state smart scale and for federal revenue to address this kind of a parallel facility to 95, as was discussed earlier. So again, to emphasize, the project remains an adopted project, prospectively to come back for an appropriation in 2021.
Okay. Any questions?
The CFO said it briefly. I think the biggest thing is, you know, that congestion, we showed, I think we scored pretty high with smart scale, but we all know all the smart scale when we went down to the end of roads this year. So it's just a matter of us getting that construction. But this just allows us and the team to do our negotiations with right of way acquisition and everything. And we're just not funding this year, but we want to fund next year.
Do you have a motion? So I'll make a motion. Second from Mr. Duncan. Excellent. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Excellent. Next, we have the approval of the transaction contract amendment.
Thank you. This item went to the Finance Committee at their June meeting. Their June meeting was actually their May meeting. There was a desire not to meet, have two meetings in June. So the finance committee basically instructed staff that as long as you have this contract amendment done and it's within budget, then bring it forward this evening. To kind of recap it, the authority signed the transaction contract in 2015 after a competitive process. That contract included the concept of ongoing technical services. Quite frankly, 4 years ago, we didn't know what they would be fully, but we knew that we were going to need them. And so the transaction contract kind of envisions these contract amendments to get these technical services done. Specifically, what we're talking about is analysis for congestion reduction estimates and transaction project ratings in support of the 24-25 update to the six-year program for the two-year update. Additionally, work will be done to do analysis for the long-term benefit assessment that is coming up as part of the transaction as well, probably part of the two-year update. We don't quite know how many applications we're going to get, so we think we used a reasonable estimate. I am happy to report back that the negotiations went very well, and we're well within the parameters that the finance committee had set for us.
Any questions?
I move the first transaction contract amendment forward.
Second. Okay, please say
aye.
Any opposed? Here's. Discussion on Mr. Norton. We have neither the chair nor vice chair of finance. Do we have anything we need for the finance committee? We actually haven't had a meeting.
Right? Well, you had the June meeting.
But it was being made. But that was before our last meeting.
Yeah.
So we haven't had a meeting since we haven't had a finance committee meeting since the last authority meeting.
Yeah.
So there's nothing to talk about. Okay. Excellent.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief, and we just want to thank the authority again for giving us funding to automate our application system. Life is so much better with the online project applications. We've been hearing from applicants that the system is working well, and again, the applications are due September the 27th, and then resolutions of support are due the following month. This item that you just approved gives us the funding to do the congestion reduction relative to cost analysis, and as Mr. Longhi noted, we are doing an assessment of long-term benefits as part of this six-year program update.
How many applications have we got so far?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, at this time. Have you even gone into count?
It would be, I was just surprised we got it. It was really easy to get it. I don't have anything else I want to say. I don't have anything else.
The letter?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. There's the letter. That is, we have a letter here that has been put in front of me about. Explain the letter.
So you have, so the letter is in front of
words on here that I can't pronounce.
The city of Alexandria asked us to provide a letter of support regarding the environmental work. Well, he did say he was going to be very late.
Yeah.
He may be too late, but they asked for a letter of support regarding the alternative B in their analysis, environmental work that's going on with the Potomac Yards Metro Rail Station. Because we have $70 million on this project, we did put it on the agenda per se because we are fully in support of the project with an investment of $70 million. So that's the first letter. The other two letters are letters of support for Prince William County's and Fairfax County's build application. Prince William asked for support for their Broad Run commuter parking lot application, and Fairfax asked for support for their Route 1 BRT application. And again, we have $250 million on the Route 1 BRT, and then with the Broad Run, while we're not funding a lot specifically, we have funded the Broad Run, I guess, relocation or extension project.
Is there any objection to me as chair signing these letters? Anything else for us, Ms. Max?
I do not have anything else. We do not meet next month. Please enjoy your summer.
Mr. Banks, Mr. Duncan, Mr. Boone, I'll get to make a second motion. Mr. Lovejoy, you want to make a motion to adjourn?
I move we adjourn.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you all very much.
All right.
Thank you.